in their area where they do their working, so that area is not a sukkah. They're not yotzei the mitzvah sukkah, and it is chayiv and mezuzah. The outer area, they are yotzei the mitzvah sukkah, but it is not chayiv and mezuzah. And last time we learned, we focused somewhat on the disputes between Rashi and the Ran. Rashi understood that the reason why the inner area is not chayiv in sukkah, is not a good sukkah, is because the area is not recognizable that it's a sukkah. The Ran, however, has a different approach. According to the Ran, the reason why the inner area where they do their work, the reason why that is going to be putter and not a sukkah, the Ran says, is because that is called a dira shel kol hashana. It is called a home, and a sukkah by definition cannot be a home. This is what we spoke about last time. I'm only reviewing that because it's actually important for the Gemara that we're going to do tonight. The Gemara says, Tanu Rabbanan, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8 lines from the top. Tanu Rabbanan. You see it? Ganbach. Ganbach is Rashi Tables. It stands for Sukkas Goyim, Sukkas Noshim, Sukkas Behema, Sukkas Kusim. Right? The sukkah that is a sukkah of goyim, the sukkah that is a sukkah of women, a sukkah of a animal or animals, and a sukkah of kutim. We'll talk about what the kutim are in a few minutes. And sukkah mikol makom, and any type of sukkah at all, kishera. These things are kosher. Ubovad shetehe misuchechet kehilchata. Providing that the schach is put up properly. So I have five types of sukkah that are mentioned over here. The sukkah of goyim, the sukkah of women, the sukkah of animals, the sukkah of kutim. And then the fifth type is any type of sukkah. And Zakhli Gemara, all of these are kosher. Last time we learned, we just mentioned a very brief point that Reb Shlomo Zalman Auerbach mentioned. He quoted it from a number of Rishonim. The Me'iri actually has this explicitly, that these cases don't seem to all be the same. The sukkah of Goyim and the sukkah of women is presumably a sukkah that was made by the Goyim, or was made by women. As opposed to the sukkah of Behema, it probably was not made by an animal, so therefore the cases are not exactly the same. But, okay, nonetheless, that's what the Gemara says. So these things are all kosher. Now we have a principle in Shas that when I have statements and they go in order, sukkah A, B, C, D, even E, so the principle is called lozu af zu. Lozu af zu means that we start with the smaller chiddush and then we build our way to the larger chiddush. That means that the largest chiddush is going to be the sukkah mikol makom, is going to be the any type of sukkah that's going to be a bigger chiddush than the sukkah of goyim, of women, etc., etc. Let's just read a little bit in the Gemara, and then we will analyze it. So the Gemara says, all these things are kosher, providing the schach is done properly, providing is mesucheches kehilchasa, providing the schach is done properly. The Gemara says, my kehilchasa. What does it mean that the schach is done properly? Amrav chista v'hu sha'asa'a l'tzeil sukkah. Providing it is made for shade. A sukkah has to be made for shade. That actually rhymed. It's cool. I didn't realize. Right? Made for shade. The sukkah has to be made for shade. Hu sha'asa'a l'tzeil sukkah. You have to make it for shade. In other words, if you build this sukkah just for tznius, you build a sukkah as noshim, just because the women need a certain amount of privacy, so that's not going to be kosher as a sukkah. It has to be a sa'ah l'tzeil sukkah. It's made for shade. So the Gemara then asks, mikom akom latuye mai? What is the sukkah that is mikom akom? What is this sukkah that is the least of all sukkahs? So the Gemara answers, Lasuye sukkas rakbash. It comes to include a sukkah of rakbash. Okay? So again, this is all what are they called? Abbreviations or something. Right, you have Ganbach, Goyim Noshim, Behema Kutim. Those are the first four sukkahs, and the Mikom Makom, any type of sukkah, includes the sukkah of Rakbash. What is Rakbash? So the Gemara explains, it's Sukkat Ro'im, Sukkat Kayatzim, Sukkat Borganin, and Sukkat Shomrei Peirot. Right? The Tanu Rabbanon that we learn, Sukkas Rakbash, Ro'im, a sukkah of Ro'im. What are Ro'im? Shepherds. The shepherds are out in the field all day. It gets hot out in the field all day. What they need to do is they build like a little area to keep them more cool. That is Sukkat Ro'im. Sukkat Kayatzim. Kayatzim are the people who dry figs. Right? They dry figs. Kayetz, what we call summertime, is named after the Zman when people dry their figs. So you have the sukkah of Ro'im, Kayatzim, the fig dryers, Borganin. Borganin are these huts that they build outside of the city. And they build these huts in order, basically, to be scouting areas. To make sure that you don't have armies, enemies, coming to attack the city. So you have the scouts who are outside. And you also have Sukkat Shomrei Peirot, the sukkah of those who guard fruits. Again, these are areas, these are sukkahs that are built for these people. So what the Gemara said is that the sukkah of the Ganbach, the sukkah of the Goyim, Noshim, Behema, and Kutim, is a good sukkah. And the sukkah Mikom Makom, which is also good, or the biggest chiddush, is the sukkah of the Rakbash, of the shepherds, of the fig garters, the town garters, etc. And then, this braisa, though, basically flips it. The Tanur Rabbanon, Sukkas Rakbash, Sukkat Ro'im, Sukkat Kayatzim, Sukkat Borganim, Sukkat Shomrei Peirot, Sukkat Mikom Makom, Kasher, Ubavad Shetei Mesuchachas Kol Chasa, Michael Chasam, Rav Chisav Rishasar, Letzel Sukkah. Mikom Makom, Lasuye Mai, Lasuye Sukkas Ganbach. Okay, so basically what we have is as follows. Our Gemara, or the way we began the sugya, it says that the sukkah of Ganbach is going to be a kosher sukkah, and the bigger chiddush than Ganbach is the sukkah of Rakbash. The Braisa says that the sukkah of Rakbash is kosher, and the bigger chiddush than Rakbash is the sukkah of Ganbach. So the Gemara says, it is five lines in the bottom, Haitana Ganbach Alibale, Haitana de Ganbach, Alimale Ganbach, Mishum de Kavi, Vikatana Mikomakom Latui Rakbash. Artana says Ganbach, that's because the sukkah of Ganbach is Kavua. Kavua means that it's always there, it's always in one place. You build a sukkah for Goyim, for women, it's always in one place. And the bigger chiddush is the sukkah of Rakbash, which is not kavua in the sense that the shepherds are nomadic and they're moving from place to place. Haytana Rakbash, alimadei Rakbash, debnei chiyuvaninhu, v'tana mikom makom latuye ganbach, delav bnei chiyuvaninhu. We say mikom makom to include ganbach, because ganbach are not bnei chiyuva. Effectively, what this Gemara is saying is that there are two perspectives. One perspective is that the sukkah of Ganbach is a bigger chiddush, because the women and the goyim have no obligation in sukkah. The other approach is that no, that the sukkah of Rakbash is the bigger chiddush, because the sukkah of Rakbash is not kavua. It moves from place to place. So effectively, we have these two different perspectives. Okay, time to take a deep breath. So, what we have over here, we're going to now begin to dissect this sugya a teeny bit. And the first point I want to discuss is based on this bottom Tosfos, the Tosfos that says Sukkat Kutim. You see it? Okay, what are the kutim? What are the kutim? So, yes, they tried to get, they gave Shlomo Tzedek and the Chaim, they tried to build the Beis HaMikdash, but the kutim began earlier than that. You know, the psukim tell us in Sefer Melachim Beis, Perek Yud Zayin of Melachim Beis. The last, or one of the last kings of Yisrael was Hoshea ben Ela. And Hoshea ben Ela is a bad king, but he's not as bad as the other kings before him. Nonetheless, Hashem is kind of all fed up with Malchus Yisrael, and Hashem sends the king of Ashur, and the king of Ashur basically goes and he destroys the city of Shomron, which is the capital of the southern kingdom. And then the king of Ashur goes and he settles some people in those cities. These are people who come from various areas, including the area of Kuta. Kuta is one of the locations that the king of Ashur takes people from, and he settles them in the cities around Shomron. The Radak comments he doesn't actually settle them in Shomron because Shomron is destroyed. Okay, grand. Now, the Kutim are interesting people. They are the forebearers of the modern-day Samaritans. What Lev commented is, aren't these the people who tried to halt the construction of the Beis HaMikdash? The answer is yes. Jewish tradition does not believe in good Samaritans. That's a Christian idea. The episode with the Good Samaritan is not Jewish, it's a Christian episode. Jewish tradition believes in bad Samaritans. The Samaritans were not particularly good people. Now, here's the thing. The Samaritans go, right, the Kutim go, and they settle in the cities around Shomron. And the Pasuk says that lions come, and the lions attack the Kutim. Right? The lions come, and they attack the Kutim. And then what happened is, and this is all in the Psukim, I'm not making it up. If you want to look in the book of Melachim Bet, Perek Yud Zayin. So then what happens is, they say, hey, what's going on? How come these people are being attacked by lions? The Radak comments that animals are supposed to be scared of humans. That's a pasuk in Bereishis. U'merachem v'chitchem yiyu al kol chayat ha-sadeh. The animals are supposed to be scared of humans. How come the lions are attacking the Kutim? So the king of Ashur says, oh, maybe it's because these people are not doing what's proper, and the God of Israel, who is in charge of this land, is not happy with these people. So then, the king of Ashur sends a Kohen, and the Kohen goes and he makes a whole long impassioned speech to the people of the Kutim. And the Pasuk says, it's the last Pasuk that's quoted on this page. Tosfos quotes at the bottom of the page, Et Hashem hayu yireim, vet Eloheihem hayu ovdim. They served Hashem and they worshipped Avodah Zarah at the same time. Now, the Radak basically comments that the Kutim originally did not even worship Hashem. The Kohen comes, and the Kohen tells them, listen guys, you know what, you want to continue worshiping your Avodah Zarah, that's fine, that's great, but you also have to worship Hashem. And they accepted that. They accepted worshiping Hashem in addition to their Avodah Zarah. I remember Dr. Lamb, Zichrono Livracha, once gave a speech, and he turned to all of us and says, do you gentlemen know what syncretism is? And like, no one had any idea what syncretism is. Well, syncretism apparently is this idea that you are worshiping one God together with some others. And that was what the Kutim did. And you get the impression from the psukim that the Kohen is instructing them, but the Kutim are not fully worshipping Hashem. They're also worshipping their Avodah Zarah. And they were attacked by lions. And there's a great debate in Jewish tradition about the status of these Kutim. Are the Kutim what we call Geirei Emet? Are they legitimate converts? Or do we say that the Kutim are Geirei Arayot, that they only converted to Judaism because of fear of the lions? Right? Because they are scared of the lions, that's why they convert. In other words, they're scared of the lions, so that's why they listen to this whole impassioned speech of the Kohen, and that's why they convert. So there's a large debate about whether the Kutim are Geirei Emet or Geirei Arayot. Now, our Gemara, okay? Our Gemara says what? The Sukkah of four groups of people is not a good Sukkah. The Sukkah of Goyim, of women, of animals, and Kutim. So our Gemara is assuming that the Kutim are bad converts, no? The Kutim are the same as Goyim. So our Gemara is assuming that the Kutim are bad converts. So Rashi writes throughout Shas that every Gemara that assumes that Kutim are bad converts goes with the opinion that you have to be a completely sincere convert to Judaism to be converted. The Gemara tells us that there's a group of people or different categories of converts that are controversial. If you convert out of fear, you're Geirei Arayot, or you convert L'shem Isha, you convert for marriage. By the way, the vast majority of conversions that I do, last week I did Geirus for the first time in a couple of months because we were holding off due to COVID-19. Last week we did four different conversions. In each case, the person who converted was converting because he or she was involved in a romantic relationship with a Jew. Is that a kosher Geirus? Is that a kosher Geirus? Now, it's not ideal, obviously. But we paskin that Geirus L'shem Ishus is good. We paskin that's good. And we paskin that Geirei Arayot is good. If you convert to Judaism because you're really scared of the lions, or the Gemara has another case, you convert like the Geirim of Mordechai and Esther, right? If you remember the Psukim at the end of Megillas, Esther writes, V'rabim me'amei ha'aretz mityahadim kinafal pachad ha'yehudim aleihem, that many people converted because they're scared of the Jews. So we paskin that all of those conversions is good. Based on this, Rashi in a bazillion places, okay, that's a technical term, a bazillion. Rashi in a bazillion places writes that every Gemara that assumes that the Kutim are the equivalent of non-Jews, every Gemara that says that is not in accordance with the halacha. The halacha says that kusim are good Jews. The halacha says if you convert for romantic purposes, it's a good conversion. Rashi would say that our Gemara, which says that the kusim are not Jewish, is going like that opinion of Rabbi Nehemiah, etc., that conversion has to be with no ulterior motives, nothing, etc. And that is against the halacha. That's what Rashi would say. Tosfos, however, over here, Tosfos, the bottom line of the Tosfos. Now you see the Tosfos Sukkas Kusim? So bottom line, Tosfos says that the Psukim and Malachim say that they're converting because of the lions. And Tosfos assumes that that for sure is no good, because if you convert out of such intense fear, that definitely is no good. And the opinion that the Kutim are good Geirim, Tosfos says, Kosavar achar kach nitkenu. That opinion says that later on, at some point in Jewish history, we don't know when, but at some point the Kutim became actually Jewish. At some point, they fully converted to Judaism. Okay, so let's just review. According to Rashi, the dispute about the Kutim is the general dispute about if you convert out of fear, is that a good conversion? And the whole story happened there in Malachim, Beis, Perek Yud Zayin. That's the way Rashi learns the Gemara. Tosfos, however, says that, you know what, the story of Malachim, Beis, Perek Yud Zayin, that wasn't a good conversion. The people were certainly not serious at that point. The opinion that the Kutim is a good conversion, that opinion is because at some later time in history, they decided to convert. That's Tosfos. So again, according to Rashi, the Sukkah of Kutim is going to be good lahalacha. Tosfos is saying that, you know what, the Sukkah of Kutim, you know what, if they at some point converted for real, it would be a good Sukkah. However, I should add a little bit of Jewish history. The Gemara at the beginning of Chulin tells us that at some point they made a din d'rabbanan that the Kutim are definitely non-Jews. The Gemara says that they found Demus Yonah Bahar Gerizim, the Shomronim, until this very day. They live in this place called Mount Gerizim. No? They have like a Beis HaMikdash there or something. And the Gemara at the beginning of Chulin says that they found a Demus Yonah, they found the image of a dove in Har Gerizim, and they made a decree midirabbanan that the Kutim are definitely not Jewish. So as a matter of halacha, we paskin min ha-Torah, the Kutim are Jewish. Rabbinically speaking, they are not Jewish. That's the basic issue in our Gemara. Now, here's the... Let me just, like, get to some of the point. I really got a lot to do. Let's just try to push on. Now, the funny thing over here is, if you take out Malachim Beis Perek Yud Zayin, and you look at Pasuk Lamed Bet, and then you look at Pasuk Mem Dalet, I think, the last Pasuk in Malachim Beis Perek Yud Zayin, you notice that the Pasuk says Ad Hayom Hazeh. The Pasuk writes that the Kutim continued with their syncretism. They continued with serving Hashem and serving their idols Ad Hayom Hazeh. And this is very difficult according to Tosfos. Because Tosfos is saying that the whole discussion of the Kutim is, at that time in history, they converted because of the lions. But later on, they converted for real. That's Tosfos' understanding. Well, one second, dude, how do you read the Pasuk? Right, the Pasuk writes, Ad Hayom Hazeh. Did anyone look up the Pasuk? It's there. Again, I could try to locate it, but the Pasuk is there. It says, Ad Hayom Hazeh. So here's the story, ladies and gentlemen. This is something I just thought about this afternoon. That's why I'm beginning with it, because I thought about it today. What does the word Ad Hayom Hazeh mean when it appears in Chumash? Or when it appears in Tanakh? What does the word until this day mean? Anyone want to take a stab at this? Everyone's so shy. What does Ad Hayom Hazeh mean? Hey, I would call on people, but no one likes to be called on. So, Ad Hayom Hazeh, until when? So, Ad Hayom Hazeh could mean until the time that that book was written. Right? And therefore, when I have Ad Hayom Hazeh in Sefer Melachim, and the Gemara tells me in Baba Basra that the author of Sefer Melachim is Yirmiyahu HaNavi. So Ad Hayom Hazeh means until the days of Yirmiyahu HaNavi. And therefore, Tosfos says that they converted later on is not so difficult. Even though the Pasuk says, Ad HaYom HaZeh, at some point later on, they converted to Judaism. That is the way Tosus would learn. But here's the funny thing. I have this sefer on Navi called the Nachlas Shimon. It's like 10 volumes. This guy, Rabbi Shimon Kirzner, he's still in the Kollel of Ner Israel in Baltimore. He must be like nearing 70 years old. He's been in Kollel like his whole life. And he writes Halachic Sfarim on Navi, which is a really interesting thing to do. So he has a whole discussion in his Nachlas Shimon, where on the Kutim, and he points out that Rashi throughout Judaism, both Rashi in Shas, and Rashi in his commentary on Chumash, Rashi writes that Ad HaYom HaZeh means a prophetic statement, which means it will never change, and Ad HaYom HaZeh means until this very day, this day being June 28th of 2020. Something like that. That is the way Rashi learns. The Rashi is found, actually, if you look in Chumash Bereshit, at the end of Parshat Vayera, we have the episode of the Akedah. So over there, the Torah writes, Asher yeomer hayom mehar Adonai yeroeh. Right, that's like the official Rosh Hashanah trap. And the Pasuk says that they say to this day that God appeared on that mountain. Rashi writes, Asher yeomer hayom, Zokt Rashi, it's the same as Ad hayom hazeh, which means l'dorei dorot. For every generation, every time, they will call that mountain the place where God appeared. That's what Rashi writes. And in fact, we know that's true, no? Different faiths, right? They all say that that mountain is where God appeared. Beautiful. But that means, according to Rashi, Ad HaYom HaZeh means until this very day. And it would seem that Rashi, therefore, cannot learn like Tosfot. According to Tosfot, the whole discussion with the Kutim is, did they convert later on? Right, that's our bottom line in the Tosfot. Did they convert at some point in Jewish history? But Rashi can't say that, because since the Pasuk in Blachim says that they were not serious about Judaism, and they served Hashem together with idols, Ad HaYom HaZeh, until this very day, so maybe, right, Rashi's going to say, oh, if they're serving God and the idol, so that's not a sincere conversion. So therefore, right, you can't say that later on they converted, because the Pasuk writes, Ad HaYom HaZeh. So that's one issue of the conversion with the Kutim. Let me just raise one other issue of the Kutim, and then we'll get back to the more famous parts of this Gemara. The other issue to talk about with the Kutim is as follows. One thing we know about the Samaritans is they never accepted the Torah Shebaal Peh, no? The Samaritans only accept the written Torah, not the oral Torah. So how on earth could anyone possibly say that the Kutim are Jewish if they never accepted the oral Torah? This is a really big problem. Especially big because the halacha follows that we mentioned it earlier. Me'ikar hadin, the Kutim are legitimate converts. Later on, they said rabbinically they're not good. But what do you mean? If you don't accept the oral Torah, how can you be a legitimate convert? So that's a very hard question. So the funny thing is that Rav Moshe Sternbuch, you know Rav Moshe Sternbuch, he is like the number two guy in the Badatz Eide Charedis. So Badatz Eide Charedis is like the most super-duper Orthodox group on the planet. And right, they put Wayu to shame. And the Badatz Eide Charedis, they're number two in command is Rav Moshe Sternbuch. And Rav Moshe Sternbuch says, you know what, you see from the episode of the Kusim, that maybe to become a convert, you only have to accept that which you are told. And it could be that the Bezdin who converted the Kutim were only telling them about Torah Shebichtav. They were not telling them about Torah Shebaal Peh. And maybe that's good enough. And maybe the reason why they are converted to Judaism and it's legit, says Rav Moshe Sternbach, even though the Pasuk says that the Kohen instructed them, you know what, also serve Hashem, is because that's what they were told. They were told, don't only worship idols, also accept Hashem. Right? This is like the biggest leniency possible in conversion. No? You would never have guessed that this comes from Moshe Sternbach. But Moshe Sternbach says, if the Beis Din tells you that it's enough to convert just because you also believe in Hashem, and the fact that you believe in the idols, okay, whatever, 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 and the fact that we don't tell you anything about Torah Shebaal Peh, whatever, 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 that's good enough. That is absolutely wild. There's a whole literature about this, about standards for conversion. Is it based on, let's say the person doesn't know halachos. The person, you know, when we convert someone, we generally, we give them a grilling, and we ask them, like, I remember the other week, we had a meeting for conversion, so we asked someone, like, how many categories of labor are there on Shabbos? So she says 39. So then we asked, okay, 39 categories, what is oreg? Right, you have to know about weaving, right? I don't assume anyone is weaving on Shabbos, but you have to know about weaving, you have to know about borer. We usually give them a grilling. There's a discussion in Poskim. Let's say you don't know certain dinim. It could be that you're still converted to Judaism if the Beis Din never tells it to you. There are opinions to that effect. Generally speaking, we don't accept that opinion. Generally speaking, we only accept the opinion that you're converted to Judaism. You have to know the basics. Shabbos, Kashrus, Taras HaMishpacha. You have to know the basics. If you're missing out on the basics, for sure it's no good. Right, Rav Moshe Sternbach is entertaining the idea, and he seems to prove it from the psukim, that the kutim are going to be legit converts, even though they are missing out on one of the most basic ideas in Judaism. I have no idea why there is a beep. Does anyone else hear this beep? Okay, I don't know what it was. But the basic idea is that Rav Moshe Sternbach entertains this idea, and he says it halacha that you see from the Kusim that as long as you do what you're told, that is good enough. Okay, so we had. Let's go back to our Gemara. We have the sukkah of goyim, of nashim, of behemos, and of Kusim. These sukkahs are going to be kosher. That's what the Gemara says, that the sukkah of goyim, of women, is a kosher sukkah. So long as it is made with shade. You have to make the sukkah for shade. That would indicate, by the way, that it's absolutely obvious that a sukkah that is not made to give shade is a pasul sukkah. No, isn't that exactly what our Gemara is saying? Our Gemara is saying that the sukkah of Noshim, Goyim, etc. Right? The Gemara says, you see the little letter Dalet in the middle of the page? V'hu sha'asa'a letzel. It's only a kosher sukkah if you make it for shade. If you don't make the sukkah with purposes of shade, it's not a good sukkah. Well, if we go back to our youth, to Daf Beis Amud Aleph in sukkah. So we had a discussion about a sukkah over 20 amos. And the Mishnah says it's non-kosher, but according to the Tanna Rabbi Yehuda, a sukkah over 20 amos is kosher. That's what we said. And the Gemara has a discussion. Why would the sukkah over 20 amos not be kosher? And according to one opinion, the opinion of Rabbi Zeira, the sukkah over 20 amos is not kosher because effectively you are getting shade from the walls rather than from the schach. To be kosher sukkah, it has to be that the shade comes from the schach. If the sukkah is too tall, so effectively the walls are going to be giving the shade, and that's non-kosher. Now here's the problem. La halacha, we say that if I have a sukkah over 20 amos, there are times when that sukkah can be kosher. Right? Let's say the walls of the sukkah connect to the schach. Right? We saw this on Daf Beis. If the sukkah is extremely, extremely tall, but the schach is right on top of the walls, so we said that like you're going to follow your eyes, you look at the wall, you go up, 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 and you'll see the schach, so therefore it's going to be kosher. But 1 second, how could it be kosher? Ultimately, I'm not getting shade from the schach. My shade is really coming from the walls. So how could a sukkah be kosher when it's over 20 amos? Even if the schach touches the walls, it should not be able to be kosher because your shade is not coming from the schach. That's a question, no? So, there is an idea that is developed by the Netziv of Volozhin. The Netziv was the Rosh Hashiva in Volozhin. Reb Naftali Tzvi Yehuda Berlin. He was, the way Dr. Soloveitchik says about the Netziv, is the Netziv was interested in underprivileged texts. The Netziv was a Rosh Hashiva, but he taught Chumash, right? Chumash is an underprivileged text. Knowing yeshiva is generally the one Gemara. Netziv taught a book called the She'iltos. Really not a popular book. Netziv also has a commentary on Shas called the Merome Sada. And in the Merome Sada in this Gemara, the Netziv is bothered by contradictions. Now, our Gemara says that a sukkah has to be made for shade. But the Netziv has around 20 or 30 Gemaras where the sukkah is not made for shade. And he comments, and Reb Usher Weiss actually develops this to a greater extent. You know, when I build my sukkah, right, in Washington Heights, behind my building, I put up a sukkah, beautiful. Why do I have schach on my sukkah? Is my schach there to provide shade? Probably not, no? If I'd want shade, I would take an umbrella. My sukkah is there because God said that there's a mitzvah to build a sukkah, no? So my schach is there for the mitzvah. It's not for shade. So how is my sukkah kosher? How is any sukkah kosher? Right? If our Gemara says that a sukkah has to be for shade, how could any sukkah be kosher? That's the question. So Netziv answers, and this is an unbelievable insight. Netziv says, hey, dude, right? Dudette. My daughter, by the way, hates it when I use the word dudette. She says, like, my high school age daughter, she says, the worst word ever. I don't know. But the Netziv writes, he says, read our Gemara. Our Gemara says that a sukkah of ganbach, a sukkah of goyim, of women, a sukkah built by goyim, built by women, built by Kutim, that sukkah has to be made for shade. Says the Netziv, because this category of people, the Ganbach category, are not fully obligated in the mitzvah, so therefore, their sukkah has to be built specifically for shade. But if I build a sukkah for a mitzvah, so by building it for the mitzvah, that sukkah is going to be kosher no matter what. Nothing to talk about, even if the sukkah is not made for shade. And therefore, our Gemara on Daf Beis that says when my sukkah is over 20 amos tall, it's going to be kosher so long as the schach touches the wall. That's referring to a situation where you make the sukkah as a mitzvah. If you build a sukkah for the mitzvah, it doesn't have to be for shade. A sukkah for the mitzvah is going to be kosher, even if the sukkah is not made for shade. That is the idea of the Netziv. Then they point out that this idea seems to be hinted at in Rashi. Look at the Rashi, Amar Rav Chista, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 lines into the wide lines. Amar Rav Chista. Amar Rav Chista. Hai kehilchata deka amar. When I say kehilchata, it means husha mesuchechet yafeh. It has to be that the schach is good schach. It's done very well. Some of the svarim say that when Rashi says mesuchechet yafeh, that means it has to be more shady than an ordinary sukkah. An ordinary sukkah requires tzilata meruba mechamata. It requires more shade than sun. But the sukkah of Ganbach requires, says Rashi, mesuchechet yafeh. It means it has to be super duper shady. Okay. By the way, that really sounds bad, no? You say that an individual is like very shady. It doesn't sound so good, but the sukkah, Rashi says, has to be very shady. Mesuchechet yafeh. Why? D'muchecha milsa shasiyasa rishona letzeo haisa v'lo letzniyas ba'alma. That indicates when you built the sukkah, it is for shade and not only for privacy. Da'af algav de sukkah l'shem chag lo be'inan, l'shem sukkah be'inan u'letzeo hu demikri sukkah shesuchechet min hachorev. Even though the sukkah doesn't have to be made l'shem chag, l'shem the mitzvah, but it has to be made l'shem sukkah, which means shade. So then the tziv says, one second, read the Rashi carefully. Rashi says, even though the sukkah is not made for a mitzvah, implying that if the sukkah would be made for a mitzvah, that sukkah would be kosher no matter what. Even though it is not made for shade. Our sukkah is not made for shade, but it still is kasher. Reb Asher Weiss actually takes this idea and he really runs with it. Reb Asher Weiss says that very often you have a mitzvah that is supposed to be done for a particular purpose. Or there are certain guidelines of the mitzvah. But if you do the mitzvah, l'shem mitzvah, even if you don't fulfill those guidelines, that's enough. Let me give you an example. You know, there's a whole discussion. You're going to think this is a lugubrious conversation. But there's a discussion. The Gemara says that when you bury someone, you should bury the person, a male. When you bury a male, you should inter the corpse wearing a talis. That's what the Gemara says. Our practice in later time has developed that the talis that we inter a corpse in is either not kosher as a talis, that we cut off one of the corners, the Chevra Kadisha does this, or they carry the mace to the grave in the talis and they remove the talis from the mace before they put the mace in. And we assume that that is good enough. Hard to know exactly how this practice developed. It's against the Gemara. The Gemara says that we bury a corpse with a talis. So Taisvis in Nida and elsewhere is bothered by a question. Taisvis in Avodah Zarah also is bothered by this question. How can you bury the mace with a talis? You are insulting the mace. We have a principle in halacha called lo'eg larash. Lo'eg larash means that I'm not supposed to do a mitzvah in a way that's making fun of someone who can't do the mitzvah. It's like saying, you know, when you're in fourth grade, na 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 kish kish, right? That's what like fourth graders say all the time. I shouldn't do a mitzvah in the presence of a mace because that's na 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 kish kish. And by that reasoning, I shouldn't have the mace, Tosis asks, I shouldn't have the corpse wearing a talus, because that's an insult to the corpse. Because the corpse is wearing a talus, and that's saying, hey, you know what, you can't wear tzitzis now, you don't get the mitzvah now, because you're dead. And we're insulting you that we put a talus on you. So how can we put the talus on you, right, if it's really an insult? So Tosis is bothered by this kasha. So Tosis has a number of answers to this question. And one of the famous answers that Tosis has is that, you know what, a corpse really has no obligation in tzitzis because he's dead. And a human living being who would be in the similar situation as the corpse would also have no obligation in tzitzis. You see, Tosis says that the obligation in tzitzis is only if the garment provides warmth. If you're dead, okay, here's the chiddush, ladies and gentlemen. If you're dead, the tzitzis, you could wear the thickest wool garment on the planet. It's not warming you up. You are dead. Il est mort. Right? He is dead. If a live person would wear a tzitzis, wear a beged, and the garment doesn't warm him up, so that person would not have a chiyuv of tzitzis.
But distinguishing between a person who's alive and a person who's dead.
So a dead person is the same as a live person. With respect to the mitzvah of tzitzis, any time the garment warms me, I'm obligated in tzitzis. If the garment doesn't warm me, I'm not obligated. So therefore, you're not insulting the dead person by having him wear a talis. Because if a live person would not be warmed by the garment, he would not have to have tzitzis. And this dead person would not have to have tzitzis. So if you have tzitzis, it's not the biggest deal. Because you have tzitzis on, it's not warming you up, not such a big deal. So now here's the kicker. Reb Asher Weitz writes, you know what? We wear tzitzis all the time, even though it doesn't warm us up. And this goes in two directions. Today was like 90-some-odd degrees in New York City. Many people, many men, were wearing wool tzitzis, no? Does it give you any enjoyment? Is there any hana'ah from wearing wool in 90-whatever degree of heat? Okay, this is a no-brainer. The answer is no, nothing. I wear a talis and shawl. Do I get any pleasure from the talis that I'm wearing in shul? Is there any hana'ah from it? No. There's no hana'ah. It doesn't provide any warmth. I have all the warmth I need from my suit. My talis, I'm only wearing it for a mitzvah. Says Reb Asher Weiss, it's the same idea that we just discussed. If you do something for mitzvah purposes, you build the sukkah l'shem mitzvah, so even though it does not provide shade, it's good enough. You make a talis l'shem mitzvah, even though it does not provide warmth, it's good enough. The same idea, says Reb Asher Weiss, it's true in both cases. So that's already an interesting idea. Ubovad shetehem esuchechet kehilchata means that the sukkah has to be made for shade. That's what Rashi writes. It has to be made with shade. Rashi writes it has to be made with abundant shade, more shade than an ordinary sukkah has. An ordinary sukkah, it's enough if it has more shade than sun. Over here, it has to be mesuchechet yafeh, grand. That's what Rashi writes.
Where we get this practice that you have to see the stars through the...
So the idea that you have to see the stars comes from a Gemara in Daf Chaf Beis. The Gemara Chaf Beis is a machlokas beshamay beselo. You have to see the stars. We pask in the halacha that it's going to be a good sukkah. It's a kosher sukkah, even if you don't see the stars. That's true.
Wow.
However, and this takes me to the next point. The Rush quotes from the Rabbeinu Tam right over here. The Rush is in chapter 1, Siman Yud Beis. The Rush quotes from the Rabbeinu Tam that when the Gemara says, Ubovad shetehem esuchechet kehilchata, that the sukkah that's built by non-Jews, by kutim, etc., right, that the sukkah has to be kehilchata, has to be proper, which Rashi learns means it has to have abundant shade, the Rush has a different explanation. The Rush explains that it means that the sukkah has to allow rain to penetrate it. The sukkah cannot be so thick that rain cannot penetrate it. The sukkah that's built by non-Jews, etc., etc., people who are exempt from the mitzvah who build a sukkah, that sukkah cannot have such a thick roof. Says the Bach. The Bach is Rabbi Yoel Sirkis, no? Rabbi Yoel Sirkis is the Rav in Krakow, Poland. The Bach, that's the Bach. He was the Rav of the largest Jewish community in his times, around the late 16th century. It's the Bach. The Bach says that if you read the Rush is saying that a sukkah built by non-Jews cannot have such a thick canopy that rain does not get into it. But any other sukkah, a person builds a regular sukkah, even if the sukkah is impenetrable by rain, it's kasher. We spoke about this on Daf Beis, right? Taisus on Daf Beis had a whole discussion about a sukkah that rain does not get into it. We noted that in our times, people came up with a new patent, a new great idea, that a sukkah could be made with like schach, that some of the schach is when you have like the lenses, there is like the concave and convex. So if I alternated my schach between concave and convex, technically speaking, could build a schach that rain is not going to ever enter the sukkah. Is such a sukkah going to be kasher? So we say yes. If you build it l'shem sukkah, even if rain does not get into it, it's kasher. The only time, right? It's the same idea that we're mentioning. The only time that the Rush quotes from the Rabbeinu Tam that a sukkah that does not allow rain to penetrate it is not a good sukkah. That is true only if it's a sukkah of Ganbach. If the sukkah is built in a somewhat inferior way, so the sukkah is going to be kasher only if it meets all the requirements. Right? That's the idea of our Gemara. The idea of our Gemara is that a sukkah that is made by people who lack a full obligation, so this sukkah has to rise to a higher level of sukkah. It has to have more shade. It has to be impenetrable by rain. Right? But if the sukkah is made for a mitzvah, by someone who has a full obligation in mitzvah, so then that sukkah is going to be kasher, even if it doesn't meet all the requirements. And that's where Rabbi Asher Weiss connected to the idea of tzitzis. Rabbi Asher Weiss also connected this to another idea, Havdalah candles, no? Right, you guys are thinking like Schwartz, I don't know what he's smoking, I don't know what's going on here, but like we're learning sukkah, why are you talking about Havdalah candles? I'll tell you why. The Gemara says that the candle that you use for Havdalah has to be a candle that provides light. The candle that provides light that you want to benefit from. If the candle for Havdalah does not provide light that you are going to benefit from, for example, if you have the lights in a shul, and the lights in the shul are not there for people to benefit from. The lights in the shul are there just because it's considered bakovedik. It's respectful to have lights on. You know, like the Ner Tamid on top of the Aron Kodesh? It's considered respectful to have a light. Or you have a Ner Shel Mesim. Sometimes people, when someone dies, right, you light a candle, it's not there to illuminate. It's there just as a sign of respect. So such a candle is not kosher for Havdalah. The Havdalah candle has to be a candle that provides light. So Nishela Tasha Ela, Rabbi Asher Weiss asks, how come we make Havdalah on our candles? Our candles, do they really illuminate? I have my electric lights on. My candles don't illuminate. I have all the light I need for my chandelier. Why do I... How can I? how can I make a Bari Marei HaEsh on my Havdalah candle? The answer that Rabbi Shawai says is the same idea that we're developing in our Gemara, right? That if you're doing it as a mitzvah, so then it does not need all these requirements. Our sugya says that a sukkah of ganbach, when the sukkah is somehow inferior, then it needs, right, a suya l'shem mitzvah, that the rain can't penetrate it, then it needs to have super duper amount of shade, etc. But a regular sukkah that's built for a mitzvah, even if it does not really provide shade, a Havdalah candle that's lit for a mitzvah, even if it does not illuminate, that is going to be kasher. That's the basic idea. That's the basic idea that he developed. Okay, so these are some of the points that I wanted to mention in this sugya. Do we have another? We're already over time. I have another piece of Torah to say, but it'll take me at least 10 or 15 minutes. So, will people forgive me if we stop now? I know that we started a few minutes late, but we went a couple of minutes over time, so it roughly balances out. If I would say the next piece of Torah that I'd like to say will take me at least 15 minutes, and my guess is that some people are tired, etc. So, again, Chevra, thank you for coming to listen. And Bli Neder, we will continue next week. Now, if people could email me and Marjorie, there is some question that Rabbi Hoffman put on the table.